First off, thank you for coming out this evening for an evening of celebration. You know, a lot of times we get together and it's just a sort of shuck and jive, but this night is very special and I am very, very excited about it. I can't tell you enough about how proud I am of the author that I'm about to introduce. You know, we're both from Louisiana, so in Louisiana, we love to embrace one another. We don't just meet people and say hi, we truly become a family. And I look at Shambe as my little brother, I look at Deidre as my little sister, and I look at this little one here as my little niece. She's been trying to steal the show all night, just trying to calm her down, you know, so it's in her blush to try to hold the microphone. But this is a night of celebration. This is a time to bring out a new poet, and it's very timely because, as you all know, we just lost a legend.
Yes.
In the poetry world. So, you know, it's that time. As we start turning the leaf, it's time to bring in the new blood. And I am very hopeful and wishful and prayerful that Shambe will reach those same heights. So without further ado, I introduce you, Shambe.
I'm gonna go on one of these chairs, so I don't sit too far away. First of all, I'd like to give all praise and thanks to the Creator, whom I've often equated to being the greatest poet that ever lived. Because out of his spoken words came life and everything that we know. The second, I'd like to thank, first of all, Shelley for putting this together on tonight. And thank you all for being here. And also, I'd like to thank my wife, because if it wasn't for her inspiration, I probably would have never become a poet, and I would have been a frustrated black man. Still mad at the world, trying to figure out where my place is. And last of all, my daughter, who really inspired me to go ahead and finish the book, because I started writing the book 10 years ago. And somewhere in the dedication, I made a separate entry for my daughter saying, "This is the wind waiting for you." In that, let me start by saying I thank you for coming to check out the reading of this book, Freedom As It Happens. Okay? Freedom As It Happens has been a long-term process. I started writing 10 years ago, came home one day frustrated, was sort of, everyone here is African-American, so I can sort of express that, frustrated with some of the things that we do to each other. And I don't think my wife had ever seen me so vexed. So I didn't know what to do with what I was feeling. And so my wife told me to write what I was feeling down. And so I sat down and I wrote a 4-page letter to a brother who thought that I saw him differently because we are of two different complexions. And after I wrote it, I shared it with the brother, and he sort of apologized for his actions. And somebody else read it and said, "You know, you should publish this." So instantly I began to say, "Well, you know what, maybe I have more things I need to get off my chest." You know, so I began writing a little bit more, and eventually putting it on the internet, and some folks started reading. I was like, and somebody eventually called the stuff poetry. And I didn't know, I mean, I grew up on things like Gil Scott Heron. Long before I knew what a poem was, I was listening to Gil Scott Heron, brothers like Dr. Hakim Mutahidi. The Last Poets, The Last Prophets, Maya Angelou, studying the works of Langston Hughes. Not really thinking myself as, you know, this is poetry, this is what it's all about, you know. Until somebody called what I was writing poetry. And then I began to say, well, you know, maybe I should study what poetry is and then see if I can actually match with a poet. And in that, I began to study the works of poets like Rumi and Pablo Neruda, and a few others like Khalil Gibran, and even the Japanese poet Basho, who was the father of Haiku poetry. And so in that development process, I began over 10 years of writing poetry. Some of the stuff I wrote a long time ago, but in the early stages, it was pretty toxic, if you will, depending on what race or opinion. And I remember sending it off to poetry.org. And poetry.org read it, and they said it's a great manuscript, but it certainly doesn't fit us. And at that point, I put the book away and said, you know what, I'm not writing a book. So I focused the next 10 years writing, doing poetry and doing audio CDs. So I released 8 albums of poetry. And over the years, folks were like, you know, you sound like you have a really interesting life. And because to me, poetry is personal. And somewhere in being a poet, I think there's a responsibility of telling the story. Whatever that story is telling the story. And part of that is all personal. It's personal to you, but it's also personal to the reader. And there's two experiences that happen in those poems. It's your reconciliation of the past, bringing it to the present, and it's the audience who reads it and brings it back and create their own perceptions of the understanding of their own life. So there are two things that happen inside every poem. There's you that happen, and then there's the reader that has an experience of their own. And you sort of get, you know, this connectedness throughout the poetry by the reading and the connections of it. So I took this collection of poetry over the last 10 years and said, you know, what am I going to do here? And I started taking some other stuff and putting it together. And Freedom As It Happens is sort of what I call a quasi-biographical book of my life, sort of put in poetic form, with some intermissions of other poetry in there. All of it connected to starting from when I was born and my perceptions of the reality in which we live in and the world that I was surrounded with, even though I grew up overseas. I grew up in Israel, where they were about 20 years behind the United States. So in the 60s, they were calling us niggas and everything else. By the 80s, Israel had just caught up. So I went through school almost as if I was Ruby D. Okay? Going through, you know, the racism, being called nigga every day, going to school, not being accepted or having citizenship because our family decided to become expats and moved overseas and decided to settle in Israel. So life for me was a little different. The perception of the United States was also a little different. And also being in the Navy 20 years and only had served in the United States as part of my duty for 6 of those 20 years. I also have a different perspective of the United States from living outside of the United States. You know, when you're in the United States, you know, when you're in the skillet, you don't really know that everything else around it is happening, you don't see what's happening inside the skillet, but if you get outside the skillet, you go, wow, there's a skillet, there's a whole world around it, you know? So when you're overseas, you know, being over here in Japan, you see other parts of the world, what you think was a struggle for you in your neighborhood or in your life also is connected somewhere else. You know, in the Philippines, they're having the same kind of struggles, cultural struggles. I was thinking of a poem I had read by Lisa Lopez Chao, a Filipino-Chinese woman who lives in the Philippines. Imagine that, Filipino-Chinese woman living in the Philippines, having to struggle with identity crisis, whereas African-Americans having to struggle with identity crisis, whether we're Africans or Americans. We're neither one because we have to have a hyphen in between our names, you know? So having to struggle with that, there's a connection around the world. I realize that black struggle is not just in America. There's a global struggle, and we just see it as black because we're only focused on what we do, but there's a global struggle and connected to with that. And poetry allows you to take that and create a parallax of reality, of your own reality, and connect it to other people's reality. So Freedom As It Happens sort of embodies all of that. It embodies what I personally experienced, and also a perception. There's accusations in the book, there are definitions, there are sort of these assumptions that are in the book, and there are also these definitions of moments in this book. And I think that anyone who picks it up and reads it could probably define a single moment in it for themselves and actually find an answer to something that they have been looking for in themselves. And it reminds me of something that Kennedy once wrote about Robert Frost. And he said that in examining art, and art in America and in a democratic society, he said, art is not propaganda. Art is a form of the truth. And I think as a form of the truth for art, and as the saying goes, the truth will set you free. Okay? So there's a connection between art, the truth, and then the truth setting you free. So it was really easy for me to come up with the title, Freedom As It Happens, because all my life I've been looking for freedom as if there was this thing on the horizon. I was constantly going for it, and I thought I had an identified thing that was going to constitute what freedom was. But what I realized was all these moments of freedoms I could have had or could have existed in, I was bypassing looking for something that did not exist on the horizon. Because, you know, we see the sun right behind the mountain, we think it's there. But if you get to that mountain, you realize it's not there. It's somewhere else. You know, if you keep trying to follow it, you get somewhere else. And it's you just keep traveling looking for the thing that you can't get to. Right? So you have to define what that freedom is. And somewhere in there between when Martin Luther King and Malcolm X was fighting for freedom, with all of Black America, the Black Panthers, or the Southern Christian Leadership Movement, or whatever it was that we were fighting for, somewhere between there and this, we lost it. We stopped fighting. And we accepted something as a form of freedom, whether that was the American dream, the big house and the picket fences and $2 a dog and kids, you know, we settled for that and it became our freedom. And what we found was we were never happy. We kept looking for something else. Or we became complacent. We said, well, you know what, it's never going to happen, so we'll just live with what we got. So, freedom is, as it happens, was that for me. So what I decided to do today is read to you, because there are like 74 pieces of writing inside this book. I can't read you the whole book, okay? So what I'm going to do is I picked some of the poems I think will sort of resonate with you, but also resonate with me, what I thought was sort of important. And I'm going to read a poem for you, and as I read the poem, I will leave a little pause in between the next poem for, you know, sort of discussion or sort of questions, if you will. Because again, like I said, to me, all poems are personal. So as you invite people to read your poetry or listen to your poetry, what you are inviting them to do is be personal. So I invite you to either ask a question or share what the poem does for you. And we'll move on to the next piece. But before I do, as Shelly alluded to, we just lost Maya Angelou. And every day I write a poem. And I write a poem and I post it on the internet. And I wrote a poem yesterday for Maya Angelou. But before I do, I'm going to read one for one of the greatest collaborators I had the chance to learn from in the study of writing, was Amir Baraka. And I wrote, and that poem is also in the book. So I'm going to share a letter I have written to Amiri Baraka after listening to one of his and reading one of his books called Something in the Way of Things. To Amiri Baraka, how do I write you a poem? You. A revolution or what needs to be. How do I write conviction without being convicted, without something in the way of things? How do I write about revolution without getting caught up trying to be down, or without feeling the Atlantic being poured through the fabric of my life? If you can catch that cotton. Full of blood, how do I shout freedom when we stop fighting, stuck in a dream? Nothing is in the way but ourselves, searching for a way out, always a way out. That was what I wrote to Amir Baraka a couple days before he passed away. And I subsequently wrote a note to him after he passed away. Because of course he never got a chance to read that at Milton. And this is what I wrote the other day for Maya. Read your letters, did we? Free from our cages, sing dirges to the moon. She was born in early spring, by summer was gone. Who knew a poet could change things? And I think that's really important. John Kennedy also wrote that when humanity loses its way, poetry will always be the more honest. And I think Maya did a great job of that. In contrast, Maya Angelou and Amir Baraka were really good friends. But they had a contrast between the two of them. See, Amir Baraka was able to write to the sense and to the appeal of the anger of the people. He talked about the things that people were frustrated to talk about. They didn't want to talk about. But Maya Angelou had a way of being able to touch the healing portions of people. She knew how to appeal to the softness of our hardness in our life. And so I think we owe a lot to them. And I think that a lot of the writers today will be able to, if they study the work, will be able to live up to what it is that she has set the bar. So I'm going to go ahead and get to some of the poems. I'm going to read from my smart device, right? And I wrote on Facebook the other day that there's a couple of books, poems in the book that are untitled. Poets have that. They have poems that they write, they don't have a title for them. And that was always a hard thing, trying to discern what I was going to title this poem. And oftentimes, titles get in the way of poems, because by the time you hear the title, the first thing you create is a judgment of what the poem is going to be. So the poem doesn't get a chance to grow on the title. So I have several untitled poems, because I want them to stand on their own merit as well. So I came up with this title for a poem, but I didn't have a poem for it, so it's sort of a poemless title. And it was called "What Happens When Poets Show Up to Events with a Smart Device and Take It with Done or Suffice." But I couldn't figure out the poem to go with that, so I just kept the title as it was. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start it out with the epigraph of what I think was mostly important. And it was the first thing I wanted people to read in the book as a sort of a statement. And it's called the epigraph. Because I want people to read the book that they feel exactly what I expect them to feel. None should ever read us without feeling pain, love, ugly, damned, wretched, and beautiful. Scarred, lost, and found, breathing and drowning, the sun in its chilling heat. They should hear a song absent fear of the dark. They should feel our nerves, sin and forgiveness, this and poverty, hungry and thirsty for more. The torments and serenity, they should find heaven in hell, because this is human poetry. So the first one I'm going to read you is called "It's an Untitled Poem," or "I Didn't Think Deep Enough." So this is Untitled Poem number 34. I told you quite a few of these are untitled. I sort of wrote this poem thinking about my life, but also the parallax of the poem. By the time I got to the end of it, I began to think about the world. So here it goes. The first mistake we make happens when we ask our children to pretend. Imagine themselves being something other than who they are. We go, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" As if, this is me speaking, as if I am insufficient of being who I am. Certainly, if I had said I wanted to be a poet, more than anything, the retort would have been, "No, seriously, think on it, and tell me a good answer." And like that, we became something less than ourselves, more of what is pleasing and acceptable to the popular. Now we are pretenders. I learned to pretend before I learned to be real. It was expected. I pretended to be emotionless, inexpressibly male, pretended to love before I knew what it was, pretended it never hurt when it did, cool when I knew I shouldn't have, acted like an actor, played my parts until they seemed like truths. I pretended until pretending made me face the real truth. Truthfully, even then, I didn't know it was real. And I couldn't tell the difference. We pretend because it is expected when everyone else is pretending too. See, I pretended to love until love got real with me. So I'm going to stop there. How did that resonate with you? And I think about that every time I get ready to ask, when I have to ask my daughter, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" When she says to me, "I want to be a poet," am I going to say, "No, seriously"? Something else. Because we all know poets don't make money. Very few poets actually make money. So, you know, what I deny her, what she really wants to be, or what I tell her to think of something else that would be more acceptable, more pleasing, and more popular. You know? Or when our children tell us they want to be the president, then we say, no, seriously. Think of something more real. So, that was the first one I wanted to read. I actually carefully selected some of them. The next one I want to read to you is poverty. Poverty, sort of rings well with me because, in a lot of ways, I thought And I miss it. None of us really want to be in poverty. So how do we define what poverty is? Right? But I was born in Cherry Hospital. And anybody in the New Orleans has been by the dome down there to see where Cherry Hospital is. And almost every black kid in New Orleans was born in Cherry Hospital. Unless you had money. You were born in Cherry Hospital. My grandmother actually worked in Cherry Hospital. But where I grew up in the ninth ward, that was poverty. Where I grew up in this ward, I thought was everything I was going to inherit for the rest of my life. Here's in that thought, I never knew what poverty was until I had an American dream. Define the illusion of our reality. And all that was became illusions and conclusions. This alluring dream defined poverty, illusion, and confluence. When the soul has no song, it is a caged bird dreaming of the sky. I didn't know what poverty was until I had an American dream. I'm going to pause there because that didn't hit you. You should really think about, I didn't know what poverty was until I had an American dream. At the time when I wrote it, I didn't think about the full magnitude of what that really meant for me. What I was really simply defining was, is because when I was a kid, I thought everything I was going to grow up with was, well, that was going to be great. That was all that I really needed in my life. And then I came to the United States in 1992, and that all redefined everything. And then all of a sudden, everything I have now, makes that poverty. But the other side to that is, in that elusive dream of chasing the American dream, we also end up in poverty. Yes. Trying to get to a certain status, yes. We end up in poverty. Because oftentimes we're never satisfied with what we have. You know, me and my wife were laughing about the fact that I remember when we thought we was going big, we had 27 inches television. You know, kind of a big guy, you know, had a TV player at the bottom. We thought we were so big that when we could afford it, we bought another one. We bought three. Until they came out with flat screen television. We was like, oh, we got an upgrade. I mean, we still don't watch as much TV as we watched then, you know. But the fact is, we're never satisfied because we always got to be. But guess what? To upgrade, it costs things, right? Sometimes you end up going in debt for those things. Mm-hmm. And then trying to figure out how you're going to pay for those things, right? So chasing that American dream, you know, we end up in poverty. A lot of Americans have ended up in poverty, chasing that American dream.
But something we see in the, you didn't know poverty because you knew the American dream. When I was listening to you speak, I was thinking about like economic dreams. I was thinking about our spiritual dream, how we, well, kind of the spiritual side, how, you know, when you're young and you're just with your people, all you see is people that love you and want to be with you.
Yes.
And then you know, you kind of settle into the world itself, and then you realize, you know, how like you mentioned before, how the world can treat you and how, you know, the world doesn't really care about you. You know, so that's kind of what I thought when I heard
you. Yes.
I didn't know poverty tonight.
Yes. Poverty is defined by many things. You know, you can be spiritually in poverty, okay? You can be emotionally in poverty. And we often gauge our emotions. I mean, just think about it. We gauge our emotions and how we feel and our status in our relationships based on others' perceptions of our relationships, others' measurements of where we should be. I mean, how many times you get, girl, you shouldn't let them treat you that way. Girl, you know, you shouldn't, I wouldn't take that if I were you. Or, man, I don't know, man, if your wife ain't cooking and cleaning, then that ain't a good wife. You know, we set our standards based on other people's definitions of what it should be. And we spend so many times looking for the right person based on these lists of scales of things that really will never fit in one person, you know? So we keep going for things, and then those definitions change as we keep trying to go for things. So you're absolutely right. And, you know, poverty is broad, and it can you can end up in poverty in so many ways. You can have all the money in the world and still be poor.
But you know, it also goes to say ignorance is bliss. So when I go home, you know, growing up, I grew up in poverty, but I didn't know I was poor. Mm-hmm. You know, because everybody was the same.
Right.
So when I go home and my friends, they're still, you know, their idea of a good time is saving up for that 40 hours on Friday night, going to Walmart and buy a nice little outfit, and man, that's Eureka. Because that's the life they want to live. And you know, because they haven't seen anything else. So but for them, that's prosperity, you know, and that's it's not necessarily a monetary or economical status. It's just a feeling. It's just how that's to them their fact. If they can, you know, kill a pig on Saturday, you know, they've got everything that they need. You guys look at how we live here in Japan. I mean, we came back and we lived in little small quarters compared to how we live in the States.
Yes.
We're not chasing or trying to compare ourselves to Jones, trying to get a car, this, that, and other. We're happy in our little jalopy driving around. You know, we're not chasing that American dream or trying to get to that status, because everybody is on that same status. And I don't think any of us are, you know, nothing less happy because of, you know, we're driving in a van or we're driving in a little jalopy. So yeah, I mean, this is what you're saying is very powerful, and that resonates with me. So.
Oftentimes, I mean, my wife will tell you, I don't eat leftovers. It's not because I don't like leftovers, but it's because when I was a kid, I was always made leftovers. But you know what? Until I was able to afford to not eat leftovers, that was happiness for us.
Right.
You know, we sat around and, you know, hey, you know, we would trade. Hey, I'll take your beans and you take the cornbread.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, hey, if you eat my squash today, I'll eat your eggplant tomorrow, because I know you don't like it. But we were happy, you know? That was richness in life for us. I mean, it wasn't, you know, the fact that there was a hole, you know, in the wall, you know, that didn't define richness for us.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that we wore the same sandals 2 years in the wall, 2 years running, you know, or you got a hole in the sock, you know. I mean, I know everyone, at least not the modern age, but most of us have gone through with sock holes in our socks or holes in the shoes or the same pair of jeans for like 4 years, you know, without having to think, oh, well, I've got to live up to the Joneses, or, I mean, we got into this the age now where it's all name brand, you know. I don't ever remember having name brands. I can tell you two name brands I had in my entire adolescent years. A Duncan Yo-Yo and a BMX bike. Those were my two name brand things that I had in my life, you know, prior to me being able to provide a different lifestyle for myself.
Yeah.
But even as I changed that lifestyle for myself, I began to define the other things as less than.
Yep.
But oftentimes we forget about the happiness that are in those times and the things that brought us together in those times.
I think one important thing, too, when we're talking about definitions, that it's so important that we define things for ourselves.
Yes.
Because when you were saying that about, I didn't know poverty until I had the American dream, I didn't know poverty until I went to graduate school.
Mm.
And we were having to read these various articles and then give a reaction. What they were describing as poor and poverty, that's how I lived. And I didn't feel that.
Right. Right.
So I decided then, just because I'm reading this in some book that some scholarly person decided to put these criteria and define that as poverty,
right.
I didn't feel that.
Right.
So because I didn't feel that, because we were all the same in that neighborhood, I'm not going to get to graduate school and allow you to say that I was poor.
Right.
Because it's not about the writing that you say or how you describe it. It's in my soul and in my spirit.
Mm-hmm.
I did not feel poor.
Right.
And in that neighborhood, when there was this guy that used to go to the grocery store, and when he came back, he would have fruits for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought he was just so... He was terrific, but we thought he was terrific to share the fruit that he bought for his family with us.
Right.
And after I got older, I realized he was buying it for us.
Right.
It was not, well, let me give you what I bought for my family. It's because all of these kids are in this neighborhood.
Yeah.
So do I call that poverty?
No.
I call that community.
Right.
You know, and I think as we have progressed, we've lost some of that. You know, when we say that we've progressed and we've come a long way. And there are some great things. even with the TV, like you were saying, when we only had one TV,
27 inch.
When we only had one TV, families watched TV together.
Yes.
When we didn't have the microwave, we sat down at the dinner table and ate together. You know, so that whole thing about the definition and what people and defining it is so critical that we define what's real for us and what's the, and I decide when I have reached whatever that dream is.
Right.
Yeah. So,
I like what you're saying. I think that what has happened over the years is that, yes, society has advanced. We've all grown. Everybody's forgotten about the simple joys.
That's right.
Like, it's the simple thing that people forget and they neglect, and those are the ones they take for granted. Most people don't even like me. I like to go around and walk because I love to look at nature. God has created a beautiful planet that has plenty of beauty. Everywhere you look, trees, flowers, the birds, when you listen to the music outside, nobody pauses for that anymore. Everybody's too busy riding around in their car, listening to their music, trying to figure out what's the latest and the greatest on the radio, or what's the current style? Why do I have to be defined by the current style? What makes me feel good? What do I like? What inspires me? And most people don't even have it because they're too busy trying to justify.
That's right.
Mission accomplished, because that American dream, I mean, the American dream is so, the way you put it in your point there, is just so broad brush. And what the American dream was to you was a little bit different for Carolyn. It's a little different for her, a little different for me. It's broad brush, it's a silent norm. It's going to graduation school, what they perceive as that dream, and the desire to go, or what makes you happy. So the American dream, as he puts it in his point, is just huge. It's whatever that thing is that now is the panacea for happiness. So it's, if you stimulate and think what that is, you know, and I think it's evoking a lot of thought in this room, is just what that is.
Well, thank you for that discussion, and I'm certainly going to take a lot of that back. Even after you write a poem, the poem, sometimes you think you're done with it, it's never done with you. it's never done with you. And even tonight, before I came here, I was going through the book and making new notes about some of the poems and some of the new directionalities that the inspiration had gone. So. The next poem I'm going to read to you is sort of a comical realness. Growing up in New Orleans, where I grew up, men did what they had to do to sort of make do for the family. They had to sometimes do some shifty things. And for me, it was more shifty. It was not just for survival of our family, but some of the things my father did that my mama didn't know about. So this next poem is called Things Mama Would Have Killed Him For. Okay, and this is sort of for my dad. And hopefully I don't get him in trouble. So, he kept a gun in case things ever got out of hand. Though it was never in his hand. Always in a shoebox above Mama's desk in the closet, half-cocked, he kept it there, loaded. Like all of his other secrets, a nickel and dime man, whatever he could hustle, twisted brass or stone, he kept them close to her heart, that place where she couldn't suspect, because if she did, he'd need more than a shoebox to hide it. My father used to keep this little pistol in the shoebox. I don't know why he kept it, because he never used it. But anytime somebody knocked on the door that he didn't invite over, he'd always go in the shoebox. Because my dad also sold, you know, weed on the side, you know? So he was always a little incredulous about who was coming to the door.
You said people were dumb.
Right. So, you know, he had a little shifty business going on the side. So, he sort of had to keep a watchful eye, you know, if you will.
My father's going to get kicked out of the house. He's going to get kicked out of the house. Yeah. All right. So there's quite a few things in there's quite a few poems, because I do believe there's a poem in here I wrote about home. It's called Home, the place you run away from. I'm not going to read that one to you. But the next poem I'm going to read to you, I'll tell you what it's about after I read it. Okay? Because I've had sort of mixed responses. I wrote this poem about 8 years ago. I had some mixed responses from the internet and some folks who heard the poem from one of my CDs, but also who read the poem on our website. And after they read it, some of the responses I got was not quite where I was going with the poem. The name of this poem is called Mulatto Blues.
Oh, I love it.
And for a while, it became one of my most requested poems to read on radio. So I'm sort of going to read it to you the same way I read it on the radio. She sang with the sweetest taboos from a lot of blues. And in her lyrics, you could hear a struggle, screams even, but you couldn't understand if you didn't live there. She wasn't quite all black, well, mostly black with a little bit of white. But if you got to know her, you'd find she was quite all right. She had caramel skin that glowed in the dark of night out of sight. See, I took the time to get to know her, and her life was nothing like you think. She wasn't just a pretty young thing and a smile. And if you get past the aesthetics, you'd find her in the darkened alley littered with spit and piss. But you could also hear the jazz of her soul lingering on the night air like faint trumpets, a little drums splashed with some flair. I mean, you could hear her. You could move your toes if you even dared to listen to her life. You could hear backs pressed against brimstones, heat exchange like baritones, riding to the ticks of metronomes like licks and kisses shared in stolen moonlight. You could feel her nightmares hanging on crescent moons while moans take flight deep into the night. And by day, you could hear her cry with pain from the stains of blood that soak her window panes, where her children who starve and thirst cry out to be returned to the earth because her breasts no longer feed. You see, for beads, she would show you her tits. And the more she showed, the more she'd get. And on a good day, she'd even dress it with a kiss laced in her blues. Let me tell you, one kiss will make you flip your wig into your pockets and lose your shoes. Watch it before begging for another swig. You'll end up hitting snooze as you cruise inside that thing that she do, like voodoo. But if you listen closely to her blues, you hear her gasping for air as though she is drowning in tears because although she's fine like silk, her breasts don't produce to feed her children as they scream for help lost in the blues. No one hears her screams as she struggles to breathe. No one wants to listen to her screams. They just want to toss more beads. They just want to toss more beads to mute her screams because no one cares to hear her screams. They just want to get lost in the melodies as they toss more beads. And no matter if you don't know her name, she could always ease your pain. Just turn down the screams of this pretty young thing as she hums her blues. If only I could sing her blues, walk a mile in her shoes, light the darkness of her alleys, I could understand the lyrics of her mulatto blues. So the first person who read that poem, as I put it on the internet, I was like, man, you must have been reading my diary. she was an exotic dancer, and she said, I just felt like you were reading my diary, because my life has been this troublesome thing, and I've dealt with so many troubles in my life, and it just felt like you just totally described my life, and I want to know how you knew me so personally. I didn't know. And I thought it was kind of funny, because I didn't know how to tell her that the poem wasn't good about what she thought it was. But I realized in that moment that poems aren't necessarily what I think that they are.
Right.
They are of the perception of the beholder. Right? So the poem might mean one thing for many, but it certainly means something else for someone else. While it might be the the exorcism of pain for me, it could be the healing for someone else. That's what I learned when this poem first came up. Folks began to ask me to read this poem on the radio for them. I realized that people were getting something other than what I intended, because they didn't get from the poem. You know, it's kind of like me giving my daughter instructions, and she gets something else out of what I said. You know, I say, go get your shoes. She thinks that means time to go. I mean, no, she gets your shoes. So, I originally wrote a lot of blues in the aftermath of Katrina. And if you understand the word mulatto is sort of a derogatory term used for women who are mixed. Okay? Sort of how we, you know, it became a derogatory term in the sense of how we treat the light skin and dark skin blend. Okay? That colorism. And
is that universal,
or? Mulatto?
Yeah.
No.
Because I was going to say that's where I'm from. Right. Mulatto, you may know, but they would say mulatto and it didn't have a negative connotation. Right. It was just, you know, it means another way of saying it. Right. Like right. That.
It's mulatto is, well, because you hear mulatto, you'll hear Creole. Right. And then they misinterpret what Creole really is. Because right. Creole is more culture, but mulatto is just the issue mixed between white and black, and the stigma is because I my 86-year-old mother just recently said one of her proudest feats is that all of her kids were black, because mm-hmm. you didn't get a say as mm-hmm. to whether or not you can give it up or whatever. So it became negative in the South because there was that connotation that you were with the white man.
Exactly.
So and I have a different because of my, you know, upbringing. I might have taken this a whole mm-hmm. different way because mm-hmm. see, the mulatto woman was she was only seen. She was only like there for pleasure. You know, mm-hmm. she was not taken seriously. She wasn't that strong black woman, the one, you know, the foundation of black society. She was basically a plaything, you know. Mm-hmm. And we also had a term called passe don, which means right. you know, compassionate wife. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times the mulatto women just, you know, we've read that book in our book, A Cane River,
yeah.
that speaks to that same, the one you didn't read, Wendy. She's not meant to be taken seriously. You are who I come to when I just want to have a good time. You know, you all you are out there is playing here, have more knees. You know, she's screaming, you know, the title of so this one again resonated with me only because of my upbringing, but the mulatto did become a derogatory thing. Although it's negative, you know, we say, oh, she's mulatto, however, she's still revered right. because of that mindset. You still have cultures like places like Plaisance Chantagne, where my sister's growing up, and I have all different shades, you had to pass brown paper bag test.
Yes. Right.
And I had some of my sisters are lighter than brown paper bags, some are not. So if they weren't lighter, they couldn't get in. So some was coming home mad because they couldn't get in. Or, you know, it might be winter, they might get in this time, you know, because they look lighter. But if you have towns like Villette Cove, where if you're, they're still light, they inbred. They marry your own sons in Louisiana to this very day. Mm-hmm. If you're not brown or whatever, but you're still a plaything, you're not taken seriously. Mm-hmm. But that's all they hold on to because it's so inculcated who they are that to be lighter, to be, you know, associated with, you know, a lighter skin makes you better somehow. But you know, so
isn't what you're saying that if you're biracial.
It's a double-edged sword. It's sort of a double-edged sword because, you know, the folks that are taken seriously, you know, are basically the, you know, the darker skin. But if you look at like New Orleans even now, it's still like what's Montreal? You know, if you look at the leadership, mm-hmm. it's only the light skin folks that are, you know, that are leaders. And they said because again, they still get that pass. There's still that stigma there.
Right.
Spike Lee made a movie about it, Jigaboos, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's the battle, it's we do it to ourselves, the light skin against the dark skin. That is still very prevalent. However, if you look at the folks that take it seriously, it's like your Condoleezza Rice. You know, it's like your Michelle Obama.
Right.
It's though, you know, it's not just a hi, you know, when they make it, you know they made it.
Right.
You know, so that's what exactly. So that's what he says.
Because there's no excuse attached to it.
You know, that's what he says, because you know they kind of get passed along because they have, that beauty, the societally accepted beauty. But you know, when you see someone that we can truly embrace and say, okay, that's a beautiful person, just because it's a beautiful person, it's not because of any stigma that's associated with what we've learned to accept as beauty. It's just, hey, that is beautiful because it is. You know, so that's what he's saying when he says that mulatto has a negative
But what I heard also in the poetry was that, yes, we have all these preconceived ideas, and some of it is based on stuff that's true.
Yes.
Because when we first start getting our own cosmetics, you will see the light-skinned people in the stores with that. You can see darker folks doing that. But saying all of that, that person is just as real as the dark person.
Yes. Right.
And we don't understand the struggles
that
those people have.
Exactly.
From being born in their skin that they didn't choose.
Right.
You know, so that's kind of, I heard the crying of that person saying, you don't, yes, I got all of this, and yes, I this, and yes, I can make you this, and I can make you spend your money.
But you don't see me.
And all that, but you don't see
you
me.
You don't see me.
You know, and if you got a chance, took the time to see me.
Right.
None of that other stuff would even matter.
But do you ascend it? I mean, and that's why poetry is so beautiful, because it stimulates thought. But even understanding that, do we see and accept people as who we are? I mean, you still don't see that. I mean, individually we may, but societally as a whole, we still don't.
But I struggle to make myself do that, and I'm thinking about something in the school system too, that like kids are in the gifted class. People don't realize that's special either. And you know why that's special?
Right.
Because academically, they're beyond where they are socially.
Right.
And they have the kids doing the same thing that folks do with the Mulatto folks. So you don't think you so much because you can go do this, or you can go do this.
Right.
And then the school system don't make it any better when you pull children out of the mainstream to have their little gifted classes.
Right.
Further really isolating and alienating and actually creating some of that things, because those kids are special ed students as well. But we don't see that. Special just means you got a unique need. And they have a unique need as well as kids who may be learning disabilities and stuff like that. And I think when we embrace the things that he's saying, and you're conscious, because we still do it, but you make a conscious decision that I'm not going to do that because this person didn't choose what skin they're in any more than I chose the skin that I'm in. So.
I like both your sides because I've lived both sides. Mississippi.
Mississippi too.
My family has the light skin. The light skin think they're better than everybody else, so there's a divide.
Right.
The dark skin has always been treated insignificant, like they don't matter. So everybody on each side is struggling with themselves because nobody chose the skin they were born in.
Yeah.
And this person doesn't like this person because of that skin. So now you have a family that's divided and can't ever come together because they don't know how to internalize and accept who they are for who they are and continue on.
Right.
So it was disrespectful to be light skinned because that makes you with massive somewhere in there. So
we have
that rainbow,
right.
And then you were just less than because you were dark skinned, you were outside in the field. So my grandmother and my generation actually experienced the field work and the housework. So when they came together to try to be a family, nobody could come together. So the screams that you hear, each one of them crying out,
Right. So you know, but the thing about it is that the beauty of education, because and I'm not talking about school education, just being educated, understanding, you know, right from wrong. It's like, you know, you gotta love, and I mean the Bible has it right, you know, you gotta love your neighbor like you love yourself. So color is not, you know, color, the parents also is aesthetics, you know?
Yes.
You know, it's like, you know, when the makeup come off, you know, all this stuff, it's all about you. And, you know, growing up in the South, you learn some pretty hard lessons, you know? And I always talk about how my mom raised her girls and she spoiled her boys. But she raised those girls. So all my sisters, with the exception of one, old enough to be my mother. So it's like living in a house with five mothers. And my sister brainwashed me so good, I didn't realize I was just average until I went to college. You know, my sisters had me, you know, my sisters had me so brainwashed and so, you know, full of myself, you know, confident, arrogant, you name it, you know, you couldn't tell me. And when I was, what do you mean? You know, that I'm not, you know, the stuff. And, you know, it was like, you know, getting deflated because, you know, they had already, you know, marched to the Capitol. They had already pumped the fist. They had already gone through, you know, the wide nose, the this, the that, the shark ear, the, you know, the, all this stuff, you know, the Cajun, you know, accent, all that, you know. So they became educated, all college educated females, that you will, you know, you are beautiful, you are all this, and you are smart, you are intelligent, you're the best, the brightest, whatever. So they did a little bit too much, you know, to try to compensate for what society had done, because being raised in Louisiana, you know, just being black, you know, just black, you know, black attributes, all that, that would have been a difficult proposition, but thank God I didn't have to go through that. But you're right, it is both on, you have those issues both on your, whether you're dark skin, whether you're light skin, or whatever. It's just those challenges that you have, but understanding, being educated, and being able to love and appreciate yourself in your own skin is how you overcome those challenges.
Hey.
Thank you. That was a great discussion. So I have just a couple more points on the read for you. And that's one that's sort of a light when I'm reading because my daughter's here. During the pregnancy, I found that my wife grew up in. And we talked about how we're going to go through the process of naming my daughter. We didn't just like, oh, you know what, we're going to pick a name out of thin air and go with that. It was a process. We went a few weeks of drawing a list of names, you know, whether it was Swahili or Hebrew or Congo or something. We were going through and we were like trying to figure out what this means. And we was like, well, you know, she's conceived in Australia, I mean, we were going through a whole lot of things. So I thought it was a very beautiful process because in the same time I was writing this book, I began writing a book specifically for my daughter. And the one I want to share with you is called Naming Your Number Two. Because I wrote several poems about the process of naming them. And I remember some of the process was even tiresome. It was like, yeah, I got this list, you know, look at it. So here's my sort of testimony to one of the days that we were sitting down and coming up with names for Nina. Today I removed seven names. It's true. None were divine enough to stay. Knowing you in this world brings beauty to an idea mostly void of it. Your mother, my wife, offers a bit of heaven. That much is the truth, I say. You'll see. The idea of you is complex, and by the end of the day, I am certain I will go through more names. Enough of that. The naming for her was really complex. So I mean, we wanted to make sure we had the right name and the right spirit. Because I think it's in naming things, you granted a spirit. You granted sort of a course that it's going to be on. I imagine, God gave Adam the power to name things, right? Imagine if you named a lion an elephant. But we know the lion to be as tough and as conquering and as regal as it is. Will we look at the elephant the other way around? So, naming is important.
So what's the significance of her name?
Nina. Well, that name sort of has two things. For one, I like Nina Simone, okay? But my wife chose the name Nina because I have a sister named Selena, my older sister. And my wife heard her name for the first time, but she fell in love with that name. And I didn't know this until we got the name. My daughter and my wife had already decided in her head when she first met my sister, that's what I'm going to name my daughter if I have one. Nina, as a derivative for the name Janina. Kai, in several languages, means sort of what I like to call in poetry, a connection. In Tagalog, the word Kai means fertility.
And Swahili means beauty. And Hawaiian, it means the ocean. And Hebrew, it means life. And another language means love. All of those things, if you take all each one of those words and connect them all together, they all are connected to each other. Life, fertility, love, the ocean, all those things are connected to each other in one way or another. So that's why I chose the name. For me, it was a Hebrew perspective I chose the name. But and her name, Kai, in several languages, means something that is connected to life. And of course, Harris is the name I didn't. I had no choice to have it. So, it took us a while to get to that. All right, so the next one, I love to read this one, and I love reading this one. The first time I read this one, I'm not sure if you were in the audience when I read this one. I read this one at a Women's History Month event that we held on the USS Blue Ridge. I wrote written it around the same time. I've prided myself that in my life I have had great examples of men in my life. But one that I think is the most important that I've had in my life has to be the fact that most of my life there were women that were very significant to who I am today. So the name of this poem is I Am Here. As time, she has always been present, sand from melted versions of itself, hands shifting in revolution, days gone, moonshine. She cries as she gives birth, gravitationally changing the course of the tide. A new day is coming. From the womb of a wounded mother, her history lives, pride to a father, strength of her worth. For 9 moons, she carried and comforted the sun with her tears, her songs, her praise. To conjure the sun from her belly. Stop dragging your feet, she'd say. The world is waiting for your light. Stop dragging your feet, son. Men don't drag their feet. Why, mama? Because men go about their business. Her wisdom was always this witty and equally persistent. Although I had great men in my life, it was the impact of these women that remained significant. Who else motivates you, keeps you on your toes, always on the job, avoiding going broke, because she certainly deserves the occasional upgrade from coach. Yeah. It was women who taught me a great lesson. My mother, a revolutionist and historian, who continued to impress upon me that despite human evolution, it's all bound to repeat itself in revolution. So learn the lesson the first time, son. Iman, who taught me what it meant to struggle, survive, and love despite the conditions, to find a woman of valor, one who will instill the same in our son. Grandmother, a nurse who magically healed the hurt with sugar and butter on toast, she gave hope to an empty stomach. She would boast more than often that I am her first. Great grandmother, one who made us pick switches, who affirms spare the switch and spoil the child beside, she was nothing to mess with. The principal woman, Shaira, who cared enough about my education, Sister Elisheva, math teacher, who taught me that 1 + 1 was sometimes circumstantial when it came to 2, since you could end up with 3 or 4 jobs trying to support the miscalculations. Sister Galina, language teacher, where syntax and context were the most important subjects. It was in her class that I learned a good deal about women. She taught me about ellipses and periods and how if missed, the consequences of misunderstood sentences. And then there was this very peculiar thing she would say. Commas are for pauses, so use prudence as you proceed. If they aren't always followed by buts, but buts are just that. Excuses. You do best to avoid this. Then there was my geography teacher who convinced me that I could be anywhere I wanted besides here. She said, stagnation is the impetus to procrastination, so go, be free. Stop stalling on what could have or should have been, for wherever you land is where you should be. I didn't understand that logically, but that is because
She was geography and not philosophy. Yes, an excuse. Then there were those who gave me theology, science, biology, love, ology, and chemistry. Speaking of which is my wife, who said the most important three words, I am here. She stood by my side, giving me the strength to overcome many obstacles. Stood on the shores, waiting my returns from far-off lands. Washed and ironed every uniform while managing a career of her own as a chemist. And we have more than chemistry. She is friend and advisor. And everything I know about the intimate respect of women, I learned from her. From her womb, the sun is born. To the light of the night sky. For you, I am here. Women deserve a lot of credit for what they're doing. So I have two last poems to do. The next poem is sort of a response of how I feel about poetry. I think that poetry has sort of multiple views. And me and my daughters used to sit every Saturday and watch this poetry video that is called Charles Gardner Poetry. And her and I would sit and it stuff from Mason Games to Emily Dickerson and all those in between. And there's a poem, see, for women. I'll tell you, she makes some trick, don't you? So there's a poem that Emily Dickerson did. And I remember one. She did, it's called Hope. Some of you may have heard it. It's sort of a popular poem in any literature, creative literature, that's generally one of the poems that is studied. But one day, her and I were sitting up, it was like 4 o'clock in the morning, I had a thing going, and I was listening to Emily Dickerson talk about hope, that thing with feathers, and I started thinking about, what, really? I mean, she makes it sound so beautiful, because that's what poetry is. If you look at the word poetry, it means to articulate something with beauty, right? So I'm like, the thing with feathers didn't mean the same thing for me when I was growing up, because we usually cook the thing with feathers. So if that's what she's describing, if she's using, a thing with feathers as an analogy for hope, then that's a problem for me. Maybe that explains a few things in my life that sort of ended up hopeless, if you will. So I decided to write the other side of what I view as Emily Dickerson's poem, Hope, the thing with feathers. And it's a sort of satire, if you will. So the title is That Thing with Feathers. Yeah, Hope. Or Sorry, We Fried It All Up. She said, Hope is the thing with feathers. But where I'm from, that thing with feathers tends to wait for the dying. Doves mourn while pigeons coo a eulogy and finches are busy fencing their latest score. In these streets, roosters are accustomed to sitting on bar stools, chatting up peacocks with their jive while eagles swoop in with that stop and frisk prejudice against birds, shooting on suspicion alone. This is how it goes down around here. Here, hope doesn't grow wings. It prays for a new set of legs so it can run twice as fast. If hope is a thing with feathers, then we have fried it crispy, let its grease run down our fingers, sucked its flesh from the bone, to which we have given to the dogs who perch themselves at the soles of our feet, worshiping as though we are gods, filling our bellies with desire. If hope is a thing with feathers, the colonel has Kentucky fried to enough to bleach his beard. Popeyes has given up spinach in favor of carpenters, while churches turn pulpit off the plate with things on the side. If hope has wings, it doesn't have a chance at flying around here because we've plucked its feathers and said grace over its crispy skin. And so the last one is one of those ones that I sort of was writing because every once in a while my wife and those of you have a significant other, especially males, because I usually always ask this question, do you love me? And it's sort of like, I'm still here, right? don't you know I love you? Like, seriously, like, but, you know, she wants to know, and I love you, you know? And that question comes up every once in a while. It's sort of like they want that reminder. It's not like they don't know you. It's sort of like, hey, I want to hear it out of your mouth because you ain't said it in 3 months. every time my wife would ask me, hey, you love me, I'm sort of wanting to look at her like, really? Seriously? You ask me that? Like, who else is going to sit up in here and, you know, just chill with you without, you know, your hair done? You know, who else is going to do that? Of course I love you, right? I've been with you for 14 years, right? So, then as I began to think about that, I began to think about the fact that what my wife is really wanting to hear is not so much that I really love her. She really wants to hear something much more different. There's something else she's listening for in that I love you. Okay? So, in my examination of what I really feel for my wife, I realized it wasn't love. Okay? And so, if you bear with me, I'm going to share with you. I think love is sort of too vain today for what I really feel for my wife. So, the name of this poem is called Elucidation. Sort of, do you love me? And here's the weird answer to that. For the sake of context, let's use the established treaties for the unit of language that lends poetic properties to the verb love. Let's use it to describe what I cannot contain for you, for it seems unbelievable that such complexity can be comprehended within the confines of two consonants and two vowels interwoven to create an understanding. When I try to describe it, I can only imagine the stars and their infinity, each in its rightful place, just for our amazement, and in the significant force it takes to hold the universe in order, the depth of God's breathing into life. And yet we call it something as mundane as love. Maybe the verb was chosen because, like a compass, it gave directionality to ambivalence. I swear it feels heavy. Prodigiously, gravitationally keeping me grounded, yet paradoxically soaring. It is immeasurable as dark matter, yet I will give it to you in the exact amount you need without request. As banal as the word love is, in more than 28 languages, it seems this single syllable word has more than a syllabus of concepts with the subject of bridging all into one, like, what else has the same thing? Peace, thought, soul, flesh. If love fits our comprehension so that we may grasp even a hint of it, so be it. I don't regret using such a common expression to give context of how I hold you when I say, I love you. Just as long as the mutualism is not as simple as the morphine infers, despite the fact it may stir a few endorphins, it is a bit more than that. It's just ineluctable to use such euphonic verb, but believe it, it's meant to do more than that just for you. So we'll go with the word love. Yeah, every time she asks me, do you love me, that's what's going through my head, okay? It's way bigger than what you think, okay? What I've given you is way bigger than this, the common I love you, you know, the commercialism of I love you. It's more than that. So when I say I'm not even sure it's really love, love will fit, but it's more, I can come up with a bigger word than four letters and two consonants and two vowels to say what I feel for you.
But